Then I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." This is the word of the Lord.
Good evening, Redemption City Church. We are here tonight to behold the Lamb. It was actually last night that my family and our community group were gathered around a table, and we were eating the Passover meal, recapitulating the Last Supper of Jesus when he gathered with his disciples to eat the Passover meal on the night before he was betrayed. And it was at that Last Supper that Jesus instituted the sacrament of communion. He took bread from the table after he and his disciples had finished eating the meal, and he said, "This is my body broken for you." And he took the cup as well after supper. It was actually the third cup of wine that they'd been drinking that night, four cups of wine traditionally drunk during the Passover meal, the third cup being the cup of redemption. And Jesus chose that third cup to say, "This is the blood of the new covenant, my blood of the new covenant poured out for you." What an astonishing moment that must have been to be there, if you were one of those initial 12 disciples, to be sitting in the presence of Jesus while he flipped the world upside down. The story goes on, and the context indicates that the disciples didn't fully comprehend, certainly, what Jesus was saying when he instituted that communion celebration, that communion memorial, that sacrament at the time, and it's probably good that they didn't. I'm not sure they would have been ready or able to handle it, because this is exactly what Jesus was doing in that moment. He was turning everything on its head. He was reversing all of the expectations that had gone before. The disciples, they were in fact gathered at that Passover meal, eagerly anticipating a Messiah. They were ready for a Savior. They were ready for someone to flip the world upside down in the way that they thought, because they had experienced the world that you and I experience. Not much has really changed in our day-to-day experience. Only the particular context has changed. They had experienced the same broken world that we experience today. They knew oppression and injustice and occupation. They knew what it was to have Roman soldiers take over their land and charge them obscene taxes. They knew what it was to have a king, Herod, declare that all the baby boys in their land should be slaughtered. They lived in the same kind of brokenness, day-to-day brokenness that we live in, that we read about. In our modern day, we see the world remains broken. We live in a world where a high school track meet can turn into a murder scene. We live in a world where immigrant children suffer the consequences of adults playing political football. The world was broken then. The world is broken now. It was broken as they gathered for the Last Supper, and the disciples are thinking, "Tell us the plan, Jesus. Tell us the plan for redemption. Tell us the plan for revolution. Tell us the plan to turn everything around, to restore
to greatness and prominence your people, the people of Israel, to throw off injustice, to end for all time pestilence and disease among the people that you love. Tell us how we will gather an army and take up arms and stand against these oppressors, these occupiers. Lead us into that new world, certainly, that you are going to create, where you are going to drive out injustice from our land. Well, the disciples were right, in one sense, at least. This was the moment of revolution. This was the moment of redemption. Salvation was indeed at hand. The kingdom of God was coming. Indeed, the king of that kingdom was in fact sitting at their very table. But Jesus, yeah. Move it along with your little speech about bread and wine. Let's get down to brass tacks. Let's get down to business. Military strategy, military tactics. The disciples had no idea just what kind of Savior Jesus is. One of the great joys of being a parent is getting to watch your very little children morph over the years into larger teenage children. Many of you are on the precipice of going through that metamorphosis. And when they're small, you know, you have to pretend that you like the movies that they like. So you have to pretend that you like Cars and Cars 2 and Cars 3. And sometimes you even convince yourself, you know what, dang it, I like that Toy Story. No, you don't. Our favorite movies as adults tend to have a bit more mature content. A coarse word there, a violent act here, because the movies that really move us are dealing with the full weighted themes of reality. Those are the movies that touch us most deeply. So one of the joys of seeing your kids turn into teenagers is you begin to be able to share your favorite movies with them. And I walked out onto the loft of our house overlooking the living room of our home recently, and to my delight, my two boys were watching one of the great all-time films, The Dark Knight. And those of you who are familiar, this is Christopher Nolan's reinvention of the superhero genre. Prior to Chris Nolan getting his hands on this Batman material, the whole superhero genre was something of a circus. It was out of control. You had characters like Arnold Schwarzenegger's Mr. Freeze, Ice to See You, that sort of thing. And Chris Nolan actually took that genre and made it far more weighty. In Chris Nolan's Gotham, we have a setting for nothing less than the primordial battle between good and evil. And so I got to talking to my son, Micah, about one of the characters in The Dark Knight, the Joker character. And I mentioned to Micah that many people believe that this Joker character, the inspiration for this character, was in fact Satan himself. And the reason why some people believe that is because of a particular scene in the film where Bruce Wayne, Batman, is pontificating about what it is that this Joker character actually wants. Bruce Wayne says, you know, at the end of the day, criminals, they're very simple. You just have to figure out what they want. And Alfred, Bruce Wayne's butler and partner in superheroing, begins to explain to Batman that perhaps this Joker character is something that he doesn't fully understand. He says, this character, unlike other criminals, isn't looking for something logical, isn't looking for money, can't be paid off. And Alfred finally says, summing up who the Joker is, some men just want to watch the world burn. And my son Micah said, correctly, it would be very difficult to defeat an enemy like that? Yes. How do you engage with an enemy who is bent on destruction? To enter into that enemy's game of destruction is to participate in the very sport that he wishes to play. To take up arms against that enemy is to step into that same destructive spirit that you are seeking to fight against. How would you go about defeating an enemy like that? And the disciples wonder, how will our master defeat the enemy of our time, the enemies that we face? What will fuel his revelation? What arms will we bear to destroy the Romans? This is my body, Jesus says. This is my blood. My assignment for tonight is to unpack the glories of Revelation chapter 5. For those of you who attend our church on Sundays, you know that we've been making our way through the book of Revelation. And through the magic of sermon series planning, we just happen to find ourselves tonight in Revelation chapter 5, which is a book about the Lamb. My sons and I, in preparing for tonight, read through this chapter multiple times, and we challenged each other to identify what were the most common themes that emerged. And so we started by circling the most common words that are present in Revelation chapter 5. And the most common word there, it occurs 8 times, is the word scroll. That makes perfect sense because this chapter is all about a scroll. It's about a particular, mysterious, heavenly scroll. It's a scroll that's very different than other types of scrolls. It's a scroll that has writing on both sides, front and back. And this scroll is rolled up. It's sealed 7 times. And it's being held in the right hand, Revelation 5 tells us, of the one who is sitting on the throne. It's being held in the right hand of God. Now, what is this scroll exactly? Well, we don't know. Bible scholars actually debate what the content, the particular content of the scroll is. There are 2 maybe leading theories as to what it might be. One of those theories is that this scroll is the land deed for the earth. Just as when you buy a home or buy a property, you receive the deed, which indicates that you are now the rightful owner, the rightful ruler of that property and land, some scholars speculate that this scroll is the land deed of the earth. Other scholars speculate perhaps this scroll contains within it the hidden secret plan of salvation of God. How it is that God is going to go about bringing to pass the new heavens and the new earth, the new creation at the end of days. The text doesn't settle this debate for us. It doesn't tell us specifically here what is in this scroll, but what it does tell us very clearly is that not anyone can open the scroll. We read this in verse 2 of chapter 5, and I saw a mighty angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And we read on in the chapter that in fact, no one in all of heaven and earth is found worthy for this assignment, is found worthy to take hold of this scroll, to break its seals, to open it, and to read it. And there's a problem here, because there is something in this scroll that is essential for life and flourishing. There is something in this scroll that is essential for accomplishing the mission and vision of God in the earth. Without this scroll, all of the world is in great peril. And this actually makes sense with any of the different possibilities that scholars debate. Any of the internal content of the scroll, is this serious? If indeed this scroll is the land deed of the earth, if no one is found worthy, if no person is found worthy of holding or opening that scroll, then humans are to be most pitied. See, because we were actually made to rule the earth. You and I were made to have dominion over the earth. We were made to be God's vice agents in the earth. What's more, we were in fact made to be God's priests in the earth. We were made to be God's stewards, cultivating, flourishing here on the earth and offering that verdant garden back to God as an offering of praise, as a sacrifice to Him. This was our land to care for and reign over. If none of us is found worthy to hold the deed, then we are disinherited of that land and we are left homeless. We are lost. We are without purpose. Likewise, if the scroll in fact contains God's hidden plan of salvation, His hidden plan of restoration and redemption, that vision is lost also if there is none found worthy to carry it out, if there's none who can bring it to completion, and we then would be lost with it. The text here tells us that John, the author of Revelation, who's being given this vision into heaven, begins to weep loudly. John is convinced in this moment that no one can be found who is worthy to carry or open this scroll. He's convinced in this moment that sin and death will have their way, that the weight of salvation is simply too heavy, the cost is too high. The purpose of this vision is to impress on John and on us that salvation, that the way of God, the vision of God, is no small matter. You know, you and I, being in church, most of us are in church often. We can get so familiar with the story of redemption that we begin to rob it of its power. We begin to undermine it of its uniqueness, of its potency. We can reduce it down to a simple mathematical formula. My sin plus Jesus equals good to go. Or worse, we can falsely presume that it's just a safety net that's there in case at some point I need it or him. What God is wanting John and us to see is just how desperate we truly are. That we are in fact hopeless to save ourselves. We are stuck in our folly and in our brokenness. Does that resonate with anyone? Have you ever looked at the course of your life and thought, wow, there are some places where I am just stuck, where this broken thing in me, this folly in me, it won't go anywhere. In fact, there's no one among us who can figure the way out of all of it. John weeps. And we all should weep along with him. How often do you just pause for a moment and reflect on just how vulnerable you actually are? Just pause and notice how vulnerable we all really are. We live on the only planet in the universe, so far as we know, that has things like air and water and food, the basic things that we need to live. We live in the only planet in the universe that even allows us to be alive. Things like day and night that regulate our sleep, temperature that's well regulated, never gets too cold. Yes, Michigan, it's true, or too hot. We can live, we can survive here, and all of these things are perfectly regulated to serve our flourishing, our survival. All of that is held in place by the hand of a creator God who, by the way, every single one of us has dishonored, disobeyed, even rejected. How vulnerable we are to simply ceasing to exist, being forgotten, Why are we here? Why are we here right now, sitting in this room, breathing? One reason, and only one. One person, and only one. Verse 5. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered, so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." The Lion of Judah, one descended from the great tribe of Judah, one anointed with power and kingship as a lion. The Root of David, one following in the lineage of Israel's greatest king, a true heir to the throne, a truer king to the truest kingdom. These titles of Jesus offered here, they underscore his strength. They underscore his rights. He is entitled to whatever throne he wants. He is truly the King of Kings. His power is unlimited. His pedigree is unquestioned. His standing in the heavens is incomparable. And yet, when John looks toward this Lion of Judah, this elder says, "There is one who is worthy." And when John looks toward this Lion of Judah, he sees something quite surprising. The scriptures tell us he sees a lamb. And he sees a lamb standing as one who has been slain. I'm not sure exactly how that works, but it was clear to John, this is no ordinary lamb. This is a lamb that has been slaughtered. And this slain lamb, this Jesus, takes the scroll from the hand of the one seated on the throne, and suddenly the heavenly host burst into song. The council of God bursts into song. And listen carefully to what they sing. It's telling. Starting in verses 9 and 10 of Revelation 5. "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." Those who sit in attendance around the throne of God, those who have special vision into the work and insight and glory of God, cry out here, "Worthy. This one is worthy to take and even open the scroll." Why? Because he's the Lion of Judah? Because he's the Root of David? The one with strength and rights? No. Because you were slain, and by your blood you redeemed the very purpose of God in his human creatures, that we would be priests again, that we would rule again, that we would step into the full mantle and vision of our creation, what God in fact made us for. Jesus did it, not with the strength of a lion or the rights of a king, but with the silence and weakness of a lamb. This was the redemption that the disciples never saw coming. When they sat at the Last Supper, thinking that they were following tradition, eating the Passover meal, eating a meal that would no doubt provide sustenance for the coming collision, for the coming battle of arms, Jesus told them, "I didn't come to show my strength. I came to be broken. I didn't come to be filled with empowerment from this Passover meal," he's saying. "I came to be the meal."
came to be the lamb, and the slaughtered one at that. The disciples never saw it coming. The world never saw it coming. And evil itself never stood a chance. Some men just want to watch the world burn. But what power are they left with when the Creator of all things willingly steps into their fire? Take your best shot, he says. Give me all of your destructive power. Ruin everything good. Destroy even this second person of the triune God. You want to watch it all burn? You want to destroy it all? Here I am. Come at me. Do your worst. Can you imagine what it would have been to be Jesus going to the cross? To be the one person who is not in any shape or form deserving of that horrific punishment. Jesus was an innocent man. The scandal of the cross is the greatest scandal ever. It's an offense. Jesus was not only an innocent man, he is innocence defined. And he takes this horrific beating. He's the rightful King of Kings. What's more, he has incalculable forces at his beck and call. If I had been in that position, I don't have any doubt what I would have done. I would have gotten out of it. Not Jesus. There is one, only one, who went like a lamb to the slaughter and made a public spectacle in doing so of every destructive power, every force that stands against God, every fire that would burn creation to the ground, every sin that you and I have picked up in our petulance to defy God. Jesus takes all of that and he swallows it whole into his very person. He takes all of the wreckage of that. He becomes the very scourge of death. He becomes the embodiment of what evil does. The destructive power of evil lands on him in full force. He takes the full weight and brunt of it, and he buries it in the ground. Another film that I very much want my teenagers to see. Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. I've read that he's producing now a movie called The Resurrection of the Christ, which I'm eager to see. But there's a scene in that film, The Passion of the Christ, where Jesus is dragging his cross to Golgotha. And the weight of the wooden cross, combined with the pure exhaustion of the beating, repeated beating that he has received prior to going to his crucifixion, is overwhelming at one point, and he stumbles and collapses. And Gibson imagines that in that moment, perhaps his mother Mary would have rushed to his side. And in the film, she rushes to his side and she says, "I'm here." And we get this flashback sequence to Jesus as a young boy when he falls, and his mother is there, "I'm here." And there's this very powerful moment in the film where Jesus looks at Mary. In that moment, broken, beaten, blood pouring through his eyes. And he says to her, "See, Mother, I make all things new." It's a line taken from Revelation chapter 21, but I think Gibson is right to imagine that this is exactly what was on Jesus' mind as he went to the cross. He went there to make all things new. And the song of the heavens crescendos. Revelation 5 tells us that the voices of angels numbering in the thousands upon thousands join with the elders and the living creatures in verse 12, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the
was slain, to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. Church, there is no one like Jesus. He is worthy of every superlative we could possibly utter. Speakers fail to give him his due. We cannot find the words. We cannot find the lyrics. We write song after song. And we cannot do right by him. Because he is so much greater than anything we have ever known, anything we have ever seen. He is to be the object of our deepest heart's affection. He is to be our worship. And when he is, all of his creation fits beautifully under his throne. When we worship Jesus, creation is truly right and good. And we stand in the kingdom of God, beholding our King above all other kings, above all other names. The great 19th century bishop J.C. Ryle put it this way: we can never make too much of Christ. We are here tonight to behold a lamb. He is a king, yes. He is the Lion of Judah, yes. But on this night, heaven and earth worship the Lamb. Verse 13. And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever. I'm going to read that again, and I want to call you to respond. I want you to read with me the quoted portion of this verse, Revelation 5:13. Let's add our voices to the chorus of heaven as if it were enough. Let's add voice upon voice upon voice, extolling the worth and beauty and glory of the Lamb. Read the quoted portion with me three times. And I heard every creature, including everyone sitting in Redemption City Church, in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and in the sea, and all that is in them, saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever. To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever. To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory.